Good morning, welcome to our meeting. It is 9:00 on April 18th, 2023. In time, we convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. We have here today Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, John Harlow, CEO, General Manager, Colin Wellenrock, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltzman, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for Board and CEO, General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PD staff. I'll now turn this over to our General Manager, John Harlow, who will facilitate the discussion. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioner Wolf. Good morning, Commissioner Olson and Logan. So we've got some great things on the agenda, and first up is our community engagement update with Laura Zorick and Ziff Orzap, and I apologize, cannot recognize Ziff.
Well, we are very excited to be here. This is Ziff. We're just onboarding Ziff today, so we have their badge all prepared, and we're just trying to make sure we find the appropriate lanyard to make sure that they're going to be very safe this weekend. And hopefully some of you guys, I mean, I know all of you are very aware because you're going to be there at our Energy Block Party, where we are excited to be able to have all sorts of great fun for the entire family. And I was going to ask Ziff, what are you most excited about? Is it the food trucks, maybe? We're going to have Dick's Drive-In. I know, John, you're planning to be our quality assurance for the food truck one, so that'll be great. Or maybe the electric vehicle car show. Yeah, I think it'll be pretty fun. We're going to have some electric bikes out there for folks to check out. But we also have lots of booths on the inside to share lots of great information about all of our programs and different things that we do around the district. But I think what you might most be excited about is the touch-a-truck portion with the ARC trailer as well. So we are very excited to have a ton of folks here this weekend. We'll just all hope for wonderful weather, and I'm so excited to have you all join us this weekend.
I believe Saturday is also Earth Day.
It is Earth Day. Oh, yes.
This is how we are celebrating Earth Day.
Exactly.
Energy consciousness and awareness, looking to the good energy that we're going to be producing.
Exactly. We'll have awesome displays in our PU Deli kind of area from the Jackson Hydroelectric Projects, the natural resources to kind of talk about bird conservation, you know, just all of the wonderful things with water conservation that we ask our customers to do all the time. So very excited to share this and have this be a key event that we can grow on for years to come, hopefully.
Thanks for all your organizing.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much. And we'll get Ziff back out here on Saturday. So looking forward to it.
Excited. Nice to meet you, Ziff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Next up is Ryan Collins with our legislative update. Good morning, Ryan. That's a tough act to follow.
I was going to say, it's not fair. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Ryan Collins, the Senior Government Relations Program Manager for the district. I'm here to update you on the 2023 legislative session. We've included our key legislative report as well as a quick presentation. The purpose of this presentation is to update the commission and is for informational purposes only. For our agenda today, I'll start with a quick overview of the legislative session's progress, review the status of our key legislation, briefly touch upon the state budget, and then open it up for questions. As always, please feel free to interrupt me at any point if you have a question or burning suggestion. So let's, with that, jump in. So as of today, we're in the last week of the regular session, which means we're on day 99 of 105. I'd like to highlight two key dates for you, one past and one future. On April 12th of last week, the legislature passed a key milestone, which was when all policy bills needed to be passed by their opposite chamber to remain alive. And this coming Sunday, which is April 23rd, is the scheduled end of the 2023 session, also known as sine die. All bills must have passed both chambers to remain alive, and the state's biennial budgets need to have passed the legislature as well, or a special session will need to be called. While each chamber continues to put the final touches of their policy conversations and finalize any outstanding legislative proposals, most of their attention now is on the biennial budgets, which are currently being negotiated behind closed doors. As I noted in previous presentations, the state's revenue projections for the coming two biennium were approximately $1 billion less than anticipated, which has infused a decent amount of chaos in the final days of negotiating this budget. We're anticipating a final agreement later this week. Initially, we were hearing Thursday for the operations budget, but it might be as late as Saturday. As for the transportation and capital budgets, it could be any moment now. For your reference, once the budget chairs reach an agreement on the budgets, a conference report is issued and presented to the legislative body. Members are only allowed a yes or no vote. And assuming the budgets do have enough votes to move forward, each budget then proceeds to the governor. Looking at our key legislation report, five of the eight proposals are still alive, and as of today, all five of the alive proposals have been passed by the legislature. Since the submission of our report last week, resource adequacy, transmission planning, and clean energy siting all received concurrence votes in their chamber of origin late Friday night of last week. That means all our key legislation will advance to the governor for final consideration and to be potentially signed into law. For your reference, there is a set timeline and process for how the governor considers signing legislation into law. Time-wise, if the bills were passed more than 5 days towards the end of session, the governor has 5 days, excluding Sunday, to act on the bill once it's been delivered to his desk. For example, the wildfire bill we are tracking was delivered to the governor last Friday, which means he has until Thursday to sign it or to act on it. For bills passed within 5 days of the end of session, the governor has up to 20 days to consider the legislation. This also is excluding Sundays. That means a bill receiving a concurrence vote in either chamber as of Wednesday of this week will have more time afterwards. Regarding actions taken by the governor, he has three: sign the bill into law, veto the entire bill, or partially veto by removing certain sections.
Question on that one. Does that mean he has line item veto?
On bills.
Already.
Correct. If the governor does not act within the allotted amount of time, the bill becomes law by default. With all the process stuff out of the way, I'd like to look at our key legislation in a little bit more detail. I'll also pause and see if there are any other questions. Hearing none. First up we have is two SHB 1032, which directs the state's Department of Natural Resources to oversee and consult with utilities on wildfire mitigation plans to help mitigate the risk of wildfires. The bill sailed through the Senate and has been thoroughly vetted by stakeholders and state agencies along the way. Since it wasn't amended in the Senate, the bill was delivered to the governor's office this past Friday and is awaiting his consideration. As I mentioned before, the governor has until this Thursday to take action. We don't anticipate a veto or partial veto of this legislation, since there was strong bipartisan support in both chambers, as well as wide support among stakeholders, including Snohomish PUD. Next up is ESHB 1329, which would prevent utilities from shutting off services during high heat events. Like the wildfire proposal, this bill passed the Senate without additional amendments and was delivered to the governor's office this past Friday and is also likely to be signed as is. Anticipating its passage, Snohomish PUD and several other utilities are continuing to have conversations with the Attorney General's office, the prime sponsor, and the governor's office to understand how best to implement the heat triggers ahead of this summer's heat season. Additionally, the governor has until this Thursday again to sign the bill into law. Well, this slide is not as critical to the conversation today as it was last week, since all our bills have now moved to the governor's consideration. I did want to detail how the concurrence process works. To be brief, to pass the legislature, identical forms of a bill needs to pass both chambers. As such, if a proposal was amended after a floor vote, differences need to be reconciled. Most typically, this occurs with a concurrence vote in the House of Origin with no additional changes. Conversely, the House of Origin can also vote to ask the opposing chamber to recede their earlier amendments. Or finally, the House of Origin can request a conference comprised of a limited number of legislators to hash out the details of a compromise. For example, this is what happens with the state budgets. If none of these actions occur, then the bill dies. Fortunately for all our proposals on a key legislation report, that won't happen since all have received concurrence votes as of last Friday. With that in mind, I want to address some quick changes to these proposals since their concurrence votes occurred. First is SHB 1117, which extends and expands the state requirement to convene annual resource adequacy meetings through 2031. The Senate, when considering this proposal, added to the language that the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory be included as part of the stakeholder group and provide analytical capacity to the discussion. The amendment appears to be non-controversial since the House concurred with these changes last Friday. The proposal is yet to be delivered to the governor, but is likely to receive a signature when he does. Next up is SSB 5165, which modifies Utilities Integrated Resource Plans, IRPs, to include transmission planning requirements. The bill originated in the Senate and during the House committee process was amended to integrate requests from the utility community, including Snohomish PUD. I've detailed some of these changes in the past, but at a high level, these sought-after changes create additional flexibility for utilities like Snohomish, which do not operate or own transmission lines. The Senate concurred with the House changes this last Friday on a vote of 36 to 10, and the proposal is now headed to the governor's office, the governor's desk, where it will also likely be signed into law.
I do have. I try to reread these things each meeting. I just have a general question that, yes, we're not a transmission utility, but those that are, this is requiring to develop transmission capacity and to work with other regions in terms of a coordinated effort. That ain't going to happen.
It's certainly a challenge.
I think the state can do it, but in terms of getting a regional, I mean, they've been working with that for 40 years. Right. So it's just an observation. I don't need an answer.
No worries. Transmission planning is hard. And I think the goal of the governor's office is to understand exactly where the capacity
that you have. Right. Yeah. No, I get that.
To your point, it is, particularly when you're going outside the state, it's a challenge. There's a reason why there's little transmission as of now. So,
well, there's a lot of discussion about this at our public power council meetings and the PNUC meetings. We've heard special presentations on the efforts that are going to be made, and I'm hopeful. I mean, I'm sure Commissioner Olson knows whereof she speaks, but we have to do that if we're going to get the energy out to where it needs to go.
Oh, Commissioner, I agree with you.
Yeah.
This interstate transmission issue, but building and siting significant
It's time
upgrades and transmission lines. It's going to be a tough road to hoe. It needs to be done, but it's
right. I think there's quite a bit of federal money to support this.
I know there.
We hope.
We hope, and I can certainly pass it off to Kim on the federal side. But I know one of the next bills we're also going to highlight is the clean energy siting. And so again, transmission and siting are clear like priorities for the state because there's not enough capacity, particularly if we're going to meet our electrification future.
Might also help with congestion issue.
Would be great. Yeah.
The other thing that relates to this, at some of these meetings that have been held in Portland, last at the beginning of the month, they're also talking a lot about other programs that could also add to transmission capabilities, such as if we go with Southwest Power Pool, if we get involved with that. They have transmission and we might be able to dig into that. I mean, I'm just learning, trying to learn all I can about this. But I'm excited about the prospects of some of the new market opportunities.
Absolutely.
But we have to have transmission.
Yeah, the transmission planning and siting, the whole transmission grid is a huge puzzle right now.
Right.
It's a very complicated
situation for not just Washington State. It's a regional and actually a west-wide issue that has to be dealt with. Resource adequacy, the markets, all the efforts around markets are going to be are going to play into what the transmission grid in the West looks like, and the ability to build transmission effectively and efficiently. Yeah, lots more to come.
Why did the legislature choose PNNL to do this work, and are they hiring to do this work, and is that who we think would be the best to?
That is a great question, Commissioner. I actually don't know off the top of my head. The amendment was issued by Senator Banky. I can check and see as to why he included them as the kind of entity to be part of this conversation. I know the Washington State University Energy Office is another one that they've usually tried to loop in on this, but I'm not entirely sure as to why Pacific Northwest National Laboratory was included in this bill.
And it's nothing against PNNL, I just would have gone the entire process to stand up a resource adequacy program. It seemed like those would be the experts that should be invited to the table.
Absolutely. I'll go back and find out a little bit more and get that information for you.
I had that same question. I'm glad you asked it. I also wondered, is there a list of all the representatives who are included in that list of entities?
I can again go
there.
I can go back and check. I know, so the original bill was passed by CETA. This again amends it so that it goes further into the future, as well as addresses some of the kind of requirements that the stakeholder group needs to consider when issuing these reports. But I can find out specifically who kind of the who are the stakeholders that are implicitly invited. No problem.
Can you read the slides
too? Oh yeah, sorry. Next bill. So we just covered transmission, and then last is going to be E2SHB 1216, which reforms the siting process for clean energy projects. As I reported over the course of the session, the bill has undergone significant revisions throughout the process. Those changes include requests from the UTC, the tribal community, large industrial customers, as well as the environmental community. These changes have further refined state agency authority over permitting, refined some industry requirements, improved processes for tribal input, as well as tried to balance local concerns with expedited project timelines. The House concurred with these changes on Friday, and the proposal is now headed to the governor's office for consideration. Like the transmission bill I just covered, this proposal will also was also requested by the governor at the start of the session and is also likely to receive his quick signature. Last but not least is the budget, which I'd like to quickly cover now. Well, we're still awaiting.
Sorry, can you go back to the previous one?
No problem.
So I'm curious, is the impetus for this the challenge on the east side for siting large projects? And did this sort of turn out in the legislature to be a west versus east kind of voting situation?
This kind of is the flip side of the same coin for the transmission conversation. Okay. I think the state leaders recognize that there is a significant need for additional transmission capacity, but also to expedite some of the siting challenges they've run into, particularly on the east side of Washington, where when you're thinking about renewable resources, sun, wind happen a little bit more out there than they do here. So this was, again, part of the process of recognizing that there's a need, there's a growing need for including renewables, but the permitting has been challenging. And so I think it's less of east versus west conversation and more a lot of stakeholders have been very interested in making sure how this gets implemented. Obviously, you have local communities who would like to keep their authority in certain permitting processes, kind of reforming some of the state SEPA processes and all these other things to make sure that, particularly when it comes to renewable generation, they can be plugged in quicker and faster.
Thank you.
No problem. So yes, budget. Well, I mentioned we are awaiting a final agreement on the proposals. As you can see, the top line spending numbers across the chambers are relatively similar. The big takeaway I'd like to leave with the commission today is that is about the spending priorities in both proposed by both chambers, which lean heavily into electrification and energy efficiency. To highlight a couple of examples, in the operating and transportation budgets, there's a significant amount of investment in electric charging infrastructure, $138 million in both chambers' operating budgets. as well as major investments in zero emission medium and heavy duty vehicles, $56 million in the Senate, and more than $200 million in various pots within the House transportation budget. There's also significant funding towards utility assistance, $75 million in the Senate operating budget, $25 million in the House, and also weatherization programs, approximately $40 million. There are also funds for building energy, for building efficiency, including $74 million to increase solar development and battery storage in community buildings, as well as $10 to $20 million for solar retrofits of public buildings. We anticipate changes to the budget as they move towards a final agreement, and we'll be closely monitoring the areas that will impact our operations and communities. And with that, I'll open up for any additional questions.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
I just have one last question. On your previous slide, LIHEAP, I thought LIHEAP was a federal program. Am I wrong?
No, LIHEAP is a federal program. It is administered by the state. You're referring to the utility assistance.
Yeah, and the difference in the budget of both houses.
Yeah, so the utility assistance program funding, again, there's differences within both chambers, but by and large, it's supplemental for LIHEAP. There's also additional grants for upgrading homes for new energy efficient programs that, again, would decrease the cost for customers.
There's the supplement to the federal.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. No problem.
I do have a question about the Navigator program to help customers guide us in how we're going to go about that. Well, partly choosing the appliances that are most efficient, most suitable for our homes, but also the funding opportunities. So is that program still going?
Unfortunately, that bill.
I saw that X by that.
Yeah, so it was the third Navigator program introduced by Representative Rammel. It made it through the policy shutoff. It didn't make it through the policy cutoff for the opposite chamber. So it died in Senate Environment and Energy Committee. That said, it seems like if you were following the conversation, which we were, it seems like more of an interim project, that this will definitely be reintroduced next year with some more fine tuning with additional stakeholder input.
Well, it's really needed because a lot of the programs that I've looked into they're not clear. They say probably will happen at the end of 2023, but we don't know yet. So there's a lot of uncertainty. So we need some help from that.
Absolutely. I think most of the legislators who are kind of following this issue completely recognize there's a massive need, particularly as the federal funds start coming down. And again, the number of appliances and what's available and who's certified to install these is important to know for customers.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you for your report.
All right, thank you, Ryan. Next up is our energy risk management report, and Peter Allenhauer. Morning, Peter.
Let's see. Just this a little bit. Hey, good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, thank you for being here.
Peter Downhauer, the Senior Manager of the Rates, Economics, and Energy Risk Management Department. I'm going to be talking to you about the energy risk situation over the last couple of quarters. So let's go ahead and jump into it. I should also say that just to acknowledge my colleague, Felicia Nang, contributed to this report and presentation.
I will say a lot of people in the public, the customers, are asking a lot of questions, so I've been telling them to zoom in and watch this today.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, hopefully I can answer all the questions.
Yeah.
Do my best. So the purpose of this presentation is obviously to report on the energy risk considerations and actions of the Energy Risk Management Committee, the ERMC, over the last period. That's covering the last couple of quarters, Q4 2022 and Q1 of 2023. Is an informational only presentation, so express expectations of the board. We've listed here some of the past meetings. Last time we were in was in October, and we reported on the Q2 and Q3 and a little bit into the Q1 of 2022 there. Prior to that, you can see that we had quarterly risk reports before we kind of changed the format there. We had a energy risk management policy and procedures workshop in December of 2021. Our agenda here is to just cover some of the energy risk background and fundamentals, to go over some of our sources of risk, and then do a retrospect of that Q4 and Q1 just recently saw. A little background, the PUD staff makes our best effort to anticipate both the consumption and of electric power by its customers and the supply of the power available. It then engages in transactions in order to meet the needs in a dependable, safe, and responsible manner. And these transactions include buying, selling, scheduling of electric power, and options for electric power or other energy commodities as necessary to meet our load and mitigate risks that we see. As far as strategies, we keep our market position near neutral in the short term, and that short term horizon that we're looking at is up to 30 months, varies, but up to about 30 months in the future. And we keep our exposure to market prices below some limits that we set that are capped to, are set to cap the impact of some of the market movements we see to no more than a 3% rate increase. We also define and update our uncertainties on a regular basis related to our generation, our loads, and our market prices that we see. And then we transact our market operations over time to sort of average out some of the prices and the market variation that we see, and that uses a tool we call the glide path.
So that second bullet there, the 3% rate increase, so is that to say that we limit our exposure so that if we had a bad year one year, the following year we would need no more than a 3% rate increase to make up for potential loss? What is that?
It's a potential, first of all, I should say it's a potential exposure, but it is, so for that 3% increase, it might be spread out over a number of years,
okay.
But more or less what you said is correct.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
I do have a question on the three. I see the 3%, that's annual. And I was curious, and I'm sorry that I didn't look that up after I read this. Isn't that 3% annual and 9% within a 3-year period? Which could mean that the sum, and within a 3-year period, the sum, 9%, no more than 9%, which means you might need to go over 3%. In 1 year, as long as over a 3-year period it doesn't exceed 9%, is that something that I made up?
No, you didn't make that up. It's two different policies. You and I are not exactly the same. It's two different policies. What you're thinking about is actually a board policy that governs our ongoing actual rate increases.
Okay.
And so your mind's in the right place,
well,
but it's a different board policy. This one is the risk management exposure piece only.
Okay.
And then we're, in order to go over a real rate increase, cumulative over a period of time, that would require you to circumvent that policy, if that helps.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry for that. Makes sense.
Adjust this without the audio setup.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Okay. Any other questions on this before I move forward? All right. So having a look at some of the variabilities we see, so historically, we see slice variability, our, you know, our hydro variability, and that's what this graphic is showing, black line being our expected slice output that we receive, and some of the bands around it being different probabilities of output that we might see in any given month. This is taken from 2012 through mid-year 2021. It does give you a sense of the type of variability we see on a hydro level.
So this is block and plus slice?
This is just slice.
Okay.
Block has a much less variability.
Okay.
Another big impact clearly is the temperature variability. As we all know, temperatures are quite a lot, and it will impact our loads and impacts the weather in the region. But in particular, when we look at our net energy situation, temperature has a big impact on loads because it will colder, we're going to have higher loads, and it's warmer, we're going to have higher loads as well. And so we're constantly seeing changes to temperature falling through to loads.
One of the readings that was recommended, I think it was part of the legislative report, but the Cliff Mass data analysis, did you happen to see that? He's saying that the data show that the cooler spring is likely to have a cooler summer following. So I thought that was interesting.
I haven't read that one, but I will follow up on that. We do, when we look at our long-range load forecast model, consider climate change and the impact of climate change in particular months. So we have tried to get a little bit more granular with that.
Right.
But that is that's a new one for me, and I'll have a look at that. Thank you. So when it comes to doing load forecasts, one key component is heating degree days. We also look at cooling degree days, but this is the heating degree day variation that we see. This is a metric that is calculated, which is 60 degrees, and we look at the average daily temperature. And between that would be the cooling degree or the heating degree days. Heating degree days are a value that come up in the winter time because homes. We use this to do our load forecasting, so you can kind of see this variation, particularly as it increases during the winter months. Fortunately, the scale is there on the bottom of the winter months would be the parts of the graph where you can see that it starts rising. As a result of that temperature and loads, I should say heating degree days, we can see the load variability in average megawatts. And this is taken from 98 to 2018, so this is a 20-year period, just notice that we do get quite a bit of potential variation, particularly in the winter where we have our peaking months. So note the peaking months through November through February, in a sort of extended range there, like the other graphs. Black line is what we expect, and then that P25 to P75 is in that orange area. That's more likely there's a higher 50% chance we'll be in those that sort of bounds. And then when we get to those further bands there, those become less and less likely on a sort of average month basis. And lastly, to note, there's wind variability. So this is looking at.
Sorry, can you go back to the previous graphic? So this is the average month megawatt.
It's the looking at a monthly basis.
Okay.
So over the course of the whole month, what would be the median?
Okay. So to compare that to like the maximum hour, what's the? Can you remind
so
us
this
what?
Last year it was 1577 on our peak week, for example. So
okay.
That occurred in December. So you can see that max hour would be off of this
off
scale.
The graph, yeah.
But if you that's only 1 hour. If you look at all the hours,
sure.
The average basis would be much lower.
Thank you.
Wind variability. Obviously, wind is quite uncertain. And so throughout a month, or wind assets, we see this sort of variability show up. It's also something to keep account of here and to plan for. So. You can see some of the higher variability in the winter months, but even throughout the year, we get quite a bit of variability. The scale there is important. So if we take April, for example, 30 average megawatts, we might get plus or minus 9 megawatts there in a P5 to P90 band. So as a result of this variability, we have target positions, also called reserve margins, that we carry deliberately into a month. So we have additional length so that we don't get surprisingly short in an expensive market. And we do that for up to 30 months in the future. And those get calculated from our hydro or wind or load, and then plus a little bit extra during the months that there's some concerns about regional generation sufficiency. And these are the components of those targets here and kind of how it's calculated. So when we look at load and wind, we add those up. And if we have a sort of market consideration that might be higher than those added up, we take that instead. So this was for 2023, I believe. So all these terms, by the way, are heavy load hour, average megawatt. So these would be sort of the heavy load component, weekday components of our targets here.
So can you walk us through the numbers for like January? I want to understand exactly what each, what's the 101?
So the 101 for the load risk would be the difference between our P50 load, our expected load, and our P95 load. That would be a higher than expected load. And our wind risk would be the other side of that. So our P50 wind down to actually P10 wind, which is the metric we have. So the low wind situation. Those would be basically added together. The assumption here is that we would have both a high load and low wind month that may or may not always correlate. So we just assume that they do in this case to create this reserve margin.
And then the 95?
So the 95 would be coming from a study from a prior study by BPA that looks at the market depth in a high load situation and a sort of resource adequacy situation in the market. And this would be our component of that study. So if you look at the whole regional requirements during that scenario and break it down into what Snowbud would be required to have, that would be essentially our component.
The component that we would need to purchase on the market?
I should say it's the component that we would required to have in order to not have that loss of load situation. Potential shortage. Yeah.
Okay,
so
okay.
If we look at all the different participants, they would all have sort of different levels of requirement based off their load, natural load. Okay, so moving now over to what happened in the last few quarters. So in retrospect, from a supply situation, we look at our Slice, Wind, Jackson, and some other resources here. Overall, you can see that that total number is 88% of what we planned for. Supplies were lower than expected. Slice was 93%. Over the whole period, but particularly you can see some months, December through February, even extending into March, lower than planned. January, in this case, was 85% of planned, February 86%. We had a little bit more wind, but that only covers so much of our Slice, which is much larger scale. And wind overall was lower. Over the whole 6 month period. Jackson as well was much lower. My colleague Mike Schnapley, I think, will be talking more about the water supply situation. When we look at the whole picture, you can see a much shorter supply than planned throughout the winter.
So, is block in this Slice number?
Block is not in this, no.
Okay.
And it's according to the plan, we were very close to our plan. I think we were on our plan. I'll refer to Mike if we have any.
Yes, we were.
Okay. As we should be. Okay. Demand was higher than planned. So when we look at our actual to budget, I know there's a lot of numbers and noise here, but I'll walk you through it here. But if we look at actual versus budget, it was 107%. So What this is telling us is that we had higher loads than we had expected, typically what's normal. We do make some adjustments as we get closer to the given month at hand, so we make two adjustments. And when we look at that, we're on average right on the mark for our adjustments, although there's some variation in between months. So what we're saying is that we had a colder, higher loads set of months that we were consistently updating as we went along. And you can see our peak week shown there. This was something I'll get into in a moment, but we had a definite excursion as far as temperatures dipping down to about 20 degrees. We also had a couple more excursions, one at the start of February, one at the end of February, and one at the sort of end of November. Our peak week, and I should say that 7 days there should be shifted slightly to the right, so apologies on that. Our peak week ends December 23rd, so that would include that sort of spike you saw, but I just want to point out here the scale is important to see. We don't usually see this. These are extremely high prices in the markets. That real-time max was $900 that we saw on the 22nd. The day-ahead max was $466 in early December, but that kind of hides the fact that, you know, even some of the other prices that we see that look like they're down at the bottom are still pretty high prices throughout January and February, $100 to $200 range. You usually see those numbers so consistently.
How long did this is just an average, how long did the 900?
That was an hourly
that
value.
Was hourly.
So it's not an average in that case. That was a single moment.
And the day ahead, was that hourly too, or was that?
So the day ahead has kind of two segments. It has the sort of heavy load and light load component. So this was for a heavy load component. $18 or so.
Right. Yeah, all those except until you get to the part of February, the whole pretty high prices.
Yep. So that was kind of the last 6 months that we've seen. It's definitely been a low water, slightly higher loads, and high market price environment. So here's our peak week. As I mentioned before, we had a maximum of 1577. And I'm gonna stop before you correct me. You'll see the prices over this week peaked at 414. That is an error on my part. So apologies for that little oversight there. The prices peaked on 1222 and 1223 during this week. I mentioned the 901 for the real time, and then the 453 was for the day ahead. For our peak week, we can look at our overall demands during the periods. And this was the highest single week that we saw. We saw average loads up to 1430 on a Thursday, and market prices corresponding to those. So we saw sort of really high day ahead real time pricing. Look at the volume, those are those bars that we see there. We were net buyers during that period, unsurprisingly, because it was our peak week. So it was a very expensive week, a very cold, high load week, for sure. Our peak was on 1222 at 9 to 10 a.m., 1577. We also like to keep track of our forecast errors, so we can look at our weather component of the year as well as the model component of the year. We see similar sort of ranges of errors that we have in the past. Generally speaking, we're less than 5% from a modeling basis. The weather errors also under 5% as well, typically.
Thoughts on the modeling error? I mean, I understand the weather error. I'm just curious what the Is it day of the week? Is it?
Yeah, yeah. So
we don't know because it's an error.
Yeah, it's part of the component that otherwise, part of the forecast model that otherwise wouldn't be explained. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we, you know, we do try to keep it within reasonable bounds. When we had the heat dome, for example, we saw a big deviation. And so, you know, what this would be telling us is in some of the cool months, we're getting higher loads than the model would expect. Mm-hmm. You know, typically this is within our bounds of error that we're mostly comfortable with, but we're always looking at improving that.
Yeah, it's not a lot of error.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it doesn't, it's an error, not due to weather, and it doesn't indicate you need to go into the model.
Say again?
The question I had was, does any of this drive looking at the model that we're using? I'm thinking not, because it isn't a great irrigation.
I don't think we're particularly worried about the size of the error.
That's what, yeah.
However, okay. I will just point out that we're constantly revising and looking at these,
yeah,
this model. And where we see big deviations, we do make changes, very purposeful changes to bring into an account, for example, more variation resulting from higher or lower temperatures. And so this is within our normal bounds of acceptability.
Okay.
That's what we do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving on to our test section. We look at a number of tests in the risk program. One of them is our current exposure. So we've got 34 approved trading counterparties that we trade with to mitigate our risks that we see. And one of them is one metric is our current exposure. So this would be the cost of all the active transactions at current market prices with each individual counterparty. So essentially, if that counterparty was no longer on the market, we had to go back and buy all that power, this would give us what that value would be. What you can see is some tests shown throughout the period per counterparty. An average exposure and the range of typical exposures are shown. We'll say that we added the counterparty in there, so the list says 34 for the next time. And we had no exceedances on this metric throughout the quarter. And just to be clear on the actual values, you see the average current exposure we see by counterparty is that black dot. And then the other dots give you sort of range of min and max that we saw throughout this period.
So with counterparty 31, the average dot is above the bar.
Yes.
But that's not an exceedance.
No, because we adjusted their limits partway through. So they, for part of this period, we did have a higher value than their final.
Oh, I understand. Months. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yep. We also look at potential exposure. So this would be those same transactions that we look at that we have with each counterparty. And then we assume that prices go the wrong way for that transaction, and whether it was a buy or a sell. When we go on the market, the prices based off of the volatilities that we've seen for those particular transactions, give it a, say it's a single month, were to increase, we have to go purchase that at those elevated prices. That's what this potential exposure is telling us. And it sums up all of those transactions per counterparty with those assumptions. This metric also adds in the current exposure. So this was a change in the way we evaluate this. So it's the combination of both the potential and the current exposure. We think it's a better measure for the potential risk that we could have for our counterparties here. And you also note that the history there is a bit abbreviated. We did not have a history of this in place, and so this is a shorter period that actually covers just the end of March through April.
That's because it wasn't done.
What's that?
That's because it wasn't done.
We
I mean, this exists. All of this good work exists because there was that function wasn't done.
We're constantly adding in new functions here. and adding in more metrics that we can show.
These analyses weren't done, and that's why this is so critical to the success of the business.
So we did have, sorry, Mr. Olson, did you have a question for me?
I was just starting on.
Okay. Feel free. We did have one limit exceedance for counterparty four. Again, this was before this history was being shown here, so it was in the last 6 months, where we did halt trading with that counterparty until that exposure came down. So that's our practice when that occurs. So this can change as prices change because of that potential metric, potential future exposure has that sort of volatility component in it. We have forward trades with that counterparty, and those prices are changing, and that volatility is changing, and that potential future exposure is also changing. So that can occur even if we've transacted with a counterparty and done nothing else and just let the market prices change. So we did have, like I said, one counterparty and exposure. We held off trading with them until that came out.
So the exceedance happened because of volatility. And when we transacted, price was a certain amount. And due to the volatility, it changed, and so now the exposure increases.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. If a counterparty already has an exceedance, we would not transact. So we'd be halting trading until that occurs. And so we can look at, you know, whether or not that would produce an exceedance and then call off the trade, essentially. Okay, continuing on then. Okay, so financial load, resource, and balance test. So this is looking at our net positions and applying it. Our net positions at slice P25, our wind and load at P50. These are our normal planning positions that we look at. And then we compare that to some risk limits that are set. And we set them. We can look at different time horizons. So it's essentially the same limit, but different horizons. For 8.8 million for a single month, 15.2 for a quarter, 34 for a year. Look at all the positions, 42.5 on average here for the book. Here is changing a little bit as we go through time. So what you're seeing here is the each individual dot there is a individual test. So we have a lot more dots in monthly tests because we have more individual months than single book. So it was taken for every couple of weeks here. This test is shown in this chart. So what you will see, and I should also mention that the scale, the y-axis there, is the percentage of that limit. So you can look at that limit. So we can kind of see on a single scale where we, the story here. So you will see that throughout the period, we had multiple calendar and book exceedances. And this was due to high market prices that we saw. And our need to retain our long positions. You see when they occurred monthly, we had quarterly, we had a single exceedance, which was dealt with quite quickly. However, the calendar and book length and the value of that has produced exceedances that we have not been willing to reduce because we've been also wanting to retain our long position in this environment. Excuse me. Okay. Equally, when we look at our price volatility tests, we can see from this chart that we've had some exceedances that we've held. There are fewer, I should note. But just explain what this test does is it says what would happen if we take those positions and prices changed on us? If we took our long positions, prices dropped. If we took our short positions, prices increased according to what our volatilities that we're seeing. And then it applies, it determines that value, the potential loss, and it does so on a weekly or daily basis, or 5-day price movements. And then we stack that up against our risk appetite there, 2.2 million for one quarter, 3.8 for, I should say 2.2 million for a month, 3.8 for a quarter, 7.6 for a year, and then all the positions, 10.6 million. So what that's saying there, these are the 5-day price movements, is that appetite is to accept that we could lose up to 7.6 million for that 1 year period, say calendar 24. If prices change, they could potentially change over 5 days, but not more. So that's what this test is doing. Again, we're seeing a lot more tests in the monthly versus quarterly versus calendar versus book, because we've got more months in them that we can look at individually. And again, you can see this sort of longer term consistent, some additional exceedances that we've had to hold through the period, again, to high market prices, high volatilities that we've seen in the need, again, to retain our long positions. So as a summary, you know, we saw exceedances over the periods due to high market prices volatility. We saw an overall long portfolio positions that we wanted to hold, and the reasons is because we want to ensure that we have sufficient energy for the variations that we see occur within a month. And we have responded to these exceedances to transact in the market, to reduce the length where possible. And we have used this in the last 6 months to kind of highlight the need for a risk strategy refresh in this environment that we're seeing, in sort of high price environments, and a risk manual update. So we're hoping to tell you a bit more about the details of that as they come. We want to make sure that our long-term portfolio risk framework is matching up really well with our short-term risk framework that we manage through the Energy Risk Management Committee.
So I'm interested in how you reduce length, or how do you determine where it's possible?
Sure.
Is that getting into the weeds too much?
No. So where we can is in months that we have additional length, but we may not be slated to transact on that in that activity month. So if we're looking forward and we're saying, you know, 2024, we might have a lot of length still. What months could we transact, but we're not yet, according to our glide path planning on doing that. And so we can start bringing those forward. Now we can start bringing those forward up to a point where we start saying, well, we're selling a lot of this forward so far in advance. It's harder to find. It's less liquid the market is less liquid, harder to find counterparties willing to transact, not as sure on the sort of pricing. You know, there's reasons why we don't want to do that. One of those reasons is because as we get closer to that month that we might trade, we have a lot more information on what we exactly have. Those variability balance that we see start becoming more and more certain. So you don't want to be in a situation where we're selling something and then having to buy it back. We try to avoid that. And also, we don't really know the value of that until we get closer to it. I mean, it's a point that we sort of balance. We want to have certainty in terms of our market purchases and sales, so that sort of price certainty is important. At the same time, we don't really know what the prices are and the value of that until we get closer, because it's related to the weather, the loads, the hydro, the resources, all of this combined.
Interesting.
So we're managing the length for, you know, because of the potential cost to us, more revenue to us.
Yes.
We're also, are we also managing a lake for resource adequacy? When we start seeing these bigger spikes?
I can say yes. We have in mind this would be a sort of longer term portfolio need. We have in mind some of the resource adequacy regional dialogue that we've seen and the changes that might occur. And this is one of the reasons why our risk manual and our risk strategy need a bit of a refresh to make sure that we're not doing something that would go against the objectives of those programs. Mm-hmm. So those signals need to be, considered together.
So really sort of the simplified approach goes back to that slide 13, that month by month risk.
Back to slide 13 for reference here.
So the low risk ones are the ones we're willing to sell some length.
That's true, yeah. So where we typically have extra length, where we think in the region, we don't have any particular worries about sort of runoff months, typically. Wintertime, definitely avoiding those months, and even thinking about some of the summertime months, which would be in the sort of preliminary thoughts of the resource adequacy program as well.
Yep.
So if everything goes according to plan, it's very easy, but it's been an interesting couple of quarters for sure. All right, I think I have a slide here that says, any questions? Oh, no, I don't. I have a crystal ball slide where I commit to being wrong about the future. but just having a look at some of the prices upcoming in the next few quarters here, we can look at third quarter, July through September, and fourth quarter of this year, October through December. For the third quarter, we can see we've had a rising prices since we've been looking at some of the market quotes out there. Periods of higher volatility sort of bumping up that prices there in early April. A bit of a leveling out, but generally speaking, we've seen some sort of rising prices over Q3, so it looks to be it's going to be a high price summer, particularly August and July.
Those are very high prices.
They're high prices, but we've kind of been looking at high prices for the last couple of years now. So this does seem to be the environment we're going to be operating in for a while.
So what does that September 6th, October 6th, what does that represent that's happening
sure.
in the market right there?
Yeah, so each one of those readings is a day, a trading day. And so as we go from the right-hand side of the graph to the left-hand side, mm-hmm. we're going back in history. We're looking at those prices and volatilities as they were calculated on that day. So when we look at 9/6/2022, that would look at on September 6th, if we were to go out to the market and try and transact on the fourth quarter of 2023, the likely prices would be and the likely volatilities would be at that point. So it's in this sense, and then if we move forward where it says 10/6, that would be if we decided to wait. You know, prices are going to change, go up and down. We're going to see some changes to our volatility, and that would be if we were now in October, looking forward to Q4 of 2023 and saying we might like to go purchase 25 megawatts. That would be the prices and the volatilities we'd see. All the way up into kind of today, the end of March there, we could say, well, price is probably pretty similar to what we see there. If we were to go out and get Q4 2023, for example.
So historically, what was going on that caused that those prices to be so high in that period? Do you remember?
Yeah, so we do know that there's some correlation between the prices we see in the short term. That should be mentioned. But the overall high price environment, we've seen high gas prices sort of driving the market prices.
Natural gas
prices, yeah. And on a forward basis. So this would be really driving those Q4 market prices because their wintertime demand is going to be higher for natural gas and also for electricity, driving up some of those winter prices there. There's also the conflict in Ukraine, which has some added sort of natural gas demand, which is also increasing those pressures. And then if we think about what happened this last quarter, we had a pretty bad water year in the region. What else was having a lot of other people were having a pretty bad water year. Not in California, but around here, for sure, right? And so we're seeing some of those effects as we see some of that sort of variation around December there. And that's, I'd say that's probably included in there as the counterparties are looking out on the market, thinking about, well, what's going to happen next year. To some extent, the expectations of this year get baked into prices and what's going to happen next year.
Sure. You know, I have a question. I've never understood. I don't really know the perspective, but the entities that are buying power on the market, like out, you know, fourth quarter, are those IOUs mostly, or are those publics? Or I'm sort of curious who sort of drives the market.
Sure. I'm gonna see if my colleague Mike Shapley would like to help me out on that one.
More than happy to answer that. I'm Mike Shapley. I'm the district's short-term power trader. I wanted to point out, first of all, you know the saying, rising tide floats all boats. If you look on that chart, remember we talked about December 22nd and 23rd? You can see that's the peak spike of these prices in Q3 and Q4 and how they have come off once you get out of that period. And so I'm sorry, I already forgot the question that was asked.
What's driving the market? Is it mostly the IOUs? What are the big buyers of power?
Yeah, so the further out you usually go on the spectrum, those are the financial companies, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley's.
So speculation.
Exactly, right. You see, generally speaking, most utilities going out at the very most 5 years, but most of them are 1 to 2.
The options traders.
Mike? I think I don't have a question slide at the end, but any other questions?
I just appreciate what you do to be able to present all of this. It's very challenging.
And this is done in a little different way, which I appreciate because I understood most of it.
Oh, good. That's what I'm aiming for.
It was done in a way that helped me.
Appreciate that.
I'm glad you got this job and not me.
believe it or not, this is really fun for me. So I enjoy this type of work. It is not a, I mean, there's you know, big decisions and important decisions made. I find it very engaging and interesting. I think, in the Energy Risk Management Committee.
Well, I just want to say, I learned a lot today, so thank you, great presentation. And really, it's a tribute to the work that you do and your group does, that our rates have been as stable as they are. Every time I see a public utility has a big rate increase, I have to wonder if this was managed as potentially as well as it could have been. So,
thank you.
You guys are doing great work.
Thank you.
And it's a fascinating time because the market really looks like it's starting to get kind of changing. So.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And like I said, we're hoping to come back to kind of talk a bit more about how we also tend to sort of mature and change our risk strategy and our risk management.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Great presentation. Thank you, Felicia, and for all the work behind the scenes as well. Next up is Mike Shapley.
Commissioner Oakley, a short break.
Did you want a break?
Yes, short break.
Okay. This is now 10:09, and we'll take a 5-minute break and come back at 10:14. We are now resuming our meeting. It is 10:14 and a half.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, now we are ready for Mr. Mike Chapley and our water supply. Morning, Mike.
Good morning. Again, Mike Chapley, the district's short-term power trader. And today I'm here to give you an update on the water supply. Again, we talk about the water year being from October through September. So this would be October 1st, 2022, and through today anyway. So the purpose is just to give you an update, no action needed. We'll take a look, first of all, at the PUD's energy portfolio mix. Take a look at this existing water year, as I mentioned, beginning October of 2022, and some of the things that impacted how we got to where we are right now, some operational impacts, and then also take a look at what the forecast is telling us it may be. Okay, so this is our 2022 portfolio mix, and obviously we've talked about this before, but in 2022, about 84% of our resources relied on hydro generation and water supply. So just a high level summary on the water year so far. Right now, our water supply forecast, I'm glad to say that as of today, is now 78% of average, but last week it was 77. So well below average at this point. We have not seen a low water like this in some time, but there's good news down the road. So originally the La Nina forecast that we had since really the beginning of the water year looked very promising, as it generally does for the Northern Hemisphere. Wet and cool conditions usually prevail on average. And so there was no need to worry in October and November, but as each month went on, things looked a little more dire, and we'll take a look at that. And so observed runoff to date is well below normal. June through September, though, should benefit from what we're seeing in terms of a delayed runoff. All months except for January were extremely cold. April itself, so far, is looking like it's going to be a record cold month. What I'm seeing is the forecast, but I've seen this before across these past months, is, you know, warming at the end of the, you know, certain period of the forecast, which is usually 10 to 14 days. But we just, it never materialized. But we're looking at the end of the month, and hopefully right into the month of May, getting back to some normal temperatures.
So do you expect that the June-September period on the Hancock and Callaghan and Youngs Creek will be able to produce more energy?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I believe in May and June are probably going to be the peak months. We've been getting more generation at Hancock Callaghan recently, anywhere from 3 to 6 megawatts. 6 is the maximum. So we are seeing better results that we've seen there, that we've seen in the past few months. And so June through September, as I mentioned, should benefit from it. And if we look at it on average, those months are looking to be about 97% of average versus the entire water year being 77 or 78% of average. So great news for those higher prices that Peter just quoted for the upcoming months of July and August especially. So California, of course, has benefited from a lot of the precipitation that we normally get here in the north. And this was really abnormal. Usually it is just the opposite. We'll see precipitation very heavy here and then in Canada, and it just never showed up. On the west coast here, we've seen pretty good. Our reservoir at Jackson is right about average, but it's been so cold that there's been nothing coming into the reservoir, so it's quite a bit lower than it is this time of year. And so you can see those numbers from Jackson through April 5th. I got from the generation group is about 73% of average for the water year, and precipitation even lower at 68% of average. But again, we're looking at, for this time of year, about 100% of average of snow there. So that should really help. Unfortunately, we're starting with the lower reservoir, but we are working towards making sure that that reservoir is full by the time we get to July 1st. Hancock, Calligan, all performed under average or P50, and same with Youngs Creek. But we'll see some benefit from those here shortly.
I'm curious on Jackson, when we measured the snowpack, how did it look at that point? I know it just moves all over the place.
Yeah, right. There's different. I don't take this for to heart, but there's three, I believe, snow sites that they fly to and do the measurements. The snow water equivalent, I think, was a little bit less than average, say 97%, but the amount of snow was anywhere from 105 to 110%. So pretty good.
So it's already dropped down to 68%.
No, so this is precipitation from the beginning of the water year, which they have a slightly different water year.
Oh, okay.
It usually start, I think their water year starts in July.
Okay.
So that is precipitation from that period in July through April. So precip for the year. Okay, so if we look back at the winter, NOAA always does a forecast for the winter, and winter months being December through February. So on the top, you'll see the map, typical La Nina forecast, where the left top map is showing what was expected, the northern hemisphere being warmer or colder than average, southern hemisphere being, I gotta mix up temperature. And so that's temperature. So temperature, yeah, below average in the northern portion, and southern portion being above average. And you can see on the right, the way that it turned out, pretty close, right? So a lot of blue there that indicates cooler than average. And you can see just how far it dipped down too. Arizona, California had some pretty cold days that they're not used to for sure. But the missing part of the piece was that La Nina season that expected in the bottom map on the left, showing above average or above median precipitation, and what we've got is below, unfortunately. So to break it down, we can look at the big map and say, okay, seasonal precipitation for the water year, October 1st through last week. A couple things to point out here is the Upper Columbia. So of course, this is what helps supply water through summer, right? And so it is below normal. We've seen better precipitation in the south. But again, this is overall precipitation throughout the year. Nothing has come off. So Upper Columbia, in terms of snowpack, is really closer to average, somewhere between 85 to 90% of average. But you can see the precip is less, but it's been so darn cold, as you can see by these maps individually by each month. October being the top map on the left, every month after that, November, December, and then top right, January has been, was the only month that had anomalies that were either at or above average, but February, March, and it looks like April as well, have all been significantly colder than average.
So this map represents the drainage system for the Columbia River, right?
Yeah, right. This is Columbia and Snake River Basin.
Is there a similar thing for BC as far as the rivers that they generate power on? It seems like, say, or they have, well, we usually have excess power. I think that's sort of a critical part of the equation. Do we look at that? I mean, obviously, you know what it means, but.
Right, and that this map does take into consideration of the very top there, we call it the shark fin. That is the upper Columbia in Canada.
So
that's what this includes.
Right, but that's not the rivers that BC Hydro is making power on, right?
Yes, no, they are, right?
Oh, they are.
Yeah, this includes the very top of the basin, Mica Dam,
okay.
All the way down.
Okay.
And so it's a coordinated effort between BC and BPA. In fact, every week we have a conference call, negotiates releases, and things like that. So yes, that's all inclusive
okay.
of the water supply basin.
Okay, so they don't have other rivers that are generating major amounts of power?
Yes, I'm sure they do. They don't feed into the Columbia River
yeah,
system.
Yeah, that's right. My question was.
Yeah, no, all the major dams
okay.
are within this, yes. Okay, and then this is just a water supply volume, so not necessarily generation, anything like that. Just wanted to show you the significance of those volumes by month since the beginning of the water year. So the green dots are the 30-year average. The blue bars are what has materialized. So every month since October, the water supply has been well below average. And you can see as we creep into the months of May and June and all the way through the end of the water year that we get closer to average in terms of water supply volume forecasts. So I wanted to note as well that if you look at some of the acronyms there, ESP10, all that really means is that it's an ensemble of a bunch of different forecasts, and it also includes 10 days of precipitation. Which is generally what we think is the most accurate. Everything after that is climatology. And that's why the water year initially looked like it was okay, right? Because if you take climatology, especially in our region where it's usually very rainy in the wintertime, everything's okay. But as the forecast continued to roll over into the 10 to 15 day, it just never really materialized. So this is a hydro comparison, 2012 through 2022. So everything excluding this year, beginning in 2012. And we use 2012 as a benchmark because right about the time that we took on the new BPA contract. And so I wanted to show you, this is how limited our flexibility was in terms of generation this year with our federal, we call it dispatchable hydro resources, ones that we have the ability to take more or less generation. This year, there was very limited time that we could take more. So the green line is the maximum amount of generation that we've seen across these years. The black is average, and you can see that the red is the minimum. We've broken some new minimum records, March, and which looks to be like April as well. October was below, a new minimum below average. But every month was very close to that minimum. So that's pretty much how dire this has been. So where's the generation come from? Generally, it's been natural gas has picked up the slack. Every natural gas generator that's out there has been running and helping to provide additional generation. Of course, along with wind and everything else, but for capacity that runs 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, it's generally speaking, whatever's left of coal, which isn't much anymore, and then natural gas. So what are we looking at coming up? So there is a pretty strong correlation that there is going to be an El Nino in the forecast. It looks to be fairly weak as we get into these spring months, which it still is. But as we get into the months of winter, there's a very high probability. I think it's about 90% probability that we're going to have an El Nino, which is not generally what we want for good water supply. Again, on average, El Nino usually produces warmer temperatures to the north with less precipitation. A great example would be 2015. That was a year when we had record generation in February because there was warm rain on snow that accumulated. By the time June came around, there was nothing left. So we're hoping this won't turn out to be the case. This period in the spring is a very uncertain period. They're because usually the El Nino or La Nina peak in December, roughly, or between November and February. And so as we get closer, we'll know more, but everything's pointing towards El Nino. Another fact is that we've just gone through the third year of La Nina. There has never been an occurrence where there's been four La Nina seasons in a row. So it's kind of set up for it. But it seems like we're breaking a lot of records too, but pretty strong signals. There's so, a lot of warming weather off of the coast of Ecuador. That is usually the first signs that you're gonna have an El Nino type of period. Okay, that's it. Any questions?
I have none, but it's always fascinating.
It's never the same. Like Peter, I really enjoy what I do, but it's like you're wrong. I mean, when I say wrong, it's less wrong, you know, than you hope to be, but you never get it right.
If Cliff Ness is right, we have a cooler summer, we're going to have less runoff.
Well,
yes,
right, exactly. And so, and then once you get into the months of July and August, which is really nice, you remember I talked about BC and BPA negotiating.
Yes.
That's when we can get additional releases from those Upper Columbia dams that aren't a part of the normal runoff, because those are the storage months when we have water in storage. That's what's happened the past couple of years in the summer months, where maybe initially we thought we weren't going to be a buyer or seller, all of a sudden we had surplus capacity that the market or used to serve our load.
I guess the big question always is, will there be enough water?
So
for everything that we
yes,
have.
Absolutely. So that's a very good point, because you have to remember that power is last on the list, right? So it's flood control, biological operations, it's irrigation, and it's recreation, and then power. So always, every year, Cooley will fill right around July 4th to its top. That's just the way it operates, it has to. So we suffer in the months when we have to fill Cooley greatly, like we do this year, just like Jackson. We've got plenty of snow. We know it's going to fill. It's just going to be the detriment of the months before that.
Water situation with Colorado, the Colorado River and Central, what is it, the Imperial Valley,
yeah,
with all the farming that's just in chaos right now. What I read.
Yes, yes, they have.
And President Biden's probably going to step in and help Russian water.
Well, right now, there's a lot of California is doing very well. Lake Powell and Lake Mead are still suffering. They've gone through like 23 years of low water. This year has certainly helped. I think Powell is has gained 25 feet, something like that, but still a lot lower than it should be.
I've seen the pictures, but somehow the Great Salt Lake has surprisingly got a new one. We thought it was going to be completely dried up. I don't know if you've read about that.
I have not.
We're getting water in Great Salt Lake again. So it seems to be reviving a little bit.
Yep.
It's just fascinating. Water.
Shasta is at a place, the northern part of California has especially benefited from all the precipitation.
Yeah.
And Lake Shasta, Lake Oroville, remember where they had this huge spill event back in, I think it was 2017 was the good water year there. Those reservoirs have really benefited and will be full for certain, because their water supply terms of rain has been significant, but you got to remember, I mean, places like Lake Tahoe, I mean, they're just buried in snow. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of good refill into the reservoirs that may need it to fill. And one other thing I wanted to mention about California too, that kind of goes into the big equation, is because they have decent amount of water supply, you know, their generation from water supply is not significant, but in good water years, it can provide up to about 50% of its water supply. Mm-hmm. But the biggest part of it is that peaking capacity. You know, when the sun goes down, the wind goes away, and everybody comes home and turns on their air conditioning, there's been years in bad water years that peak capacity goes away in June or July. They'll have peaking capacity all the way through their warmest month of September. So that should help temper prices a little bit. We don't know if those really high prices of July and August are going to materialize. Certainly if we have a cooler summer, they will not.
Well, municipal water supplies for people, for human consumption, is part of that.
Absolutely.
Challenge.
Yeah. Arizona has grown too much.
Yeah.
Part of the reason that Mead and Powell are as low as they are is because of all the development.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the things that Mike mentioned, though, that I think is worthy of note is because of this shortage of hydro, the delta or the gap is being made up by natural gas and what's left of coal. And as we continue to move towards our CEDA requirements, those go away. And what's being built to make up that gap for years like this? So again, that's just a, you know, longer term, but those are the opportunities and the challenges that we're gonna have to confront. It goes back to that transmission planning and building and the markets and resource adequacy, all of this ties together, and it's how we navigate that, not just us, not just the state, but the region and the entire west part of the country.
It's not the sleepy, boring industry that it used to be, that's for sure.
Not at all. No.
Hey, thank you.
That's why the markets, this whole markets, the world of markets is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And necessary, and thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Great job. Jason is just going to touch on a couple things that we wanted to make the board aware of.
Sure.
Jason. Yeah. Jason Zyskowski, Assistant General Manager for Facilities Generation, Power Agency Transmission. First off, just want to give a shout out to Peter and Mike for the great presentations this morning. And that whole energy risk management team does an excellent job managing through difficult times as these. I really appreciate their focus on just the continuous improvement that we're working on right now with the refresh of the strategy. Want to highlight one thing related to budget, and that is our power purchase budget and then also our sales. So due to the extremely low water, we've been having a lot less slice generation than we expect, and we've also been having the colder temperatures, which have driven up our loads a little bit. So we have been out in the market purchasing a fair amount of power at high prices. And so what that has done is, you know, we have spent more than expected of our power purchase budget at this point in the year. So the fiscal year, I'm just talking 2023, we still have a ways to go. We haven't had a lot of sales, but we are forecasting as we go through this year that those sales are not going to make up for the level of purchases that we've had. And so basically, long story short, we were going to be over on our power purchasing budget, and it's looking like it could be pretty significant. And so we're working as the whole ELT to take a look at that and really how we can manage other costs to balance that out through the rest of the year. The good thing is it's still early in the year. It's April. We have time to make those adjustments, and also, we'll see how the rest of the water year goes. That snow is still up there in the upper Columbia, and hopefully that'll come down in June, July, August, September, and maybe the water, the net of our purchases and sales won't turn out as bad, but we're definitely forecasting that, looking at that, and planning for that.
Well, I'm sure we're all very, three of us, certainly I am very interested in what you're working on with that, and good luck.
Yeah, thank you. And we will give more information the next commission meeting. We would give the quarterly financials, so you'll see some of those numbers, and we'll be able to report on, you know, kind of our actions to make up those differences.
Sure. Just an observation, I picked up on, those are big numbers that management is looking at being able to somehow fill that gap to cover those losses. That's tough to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's such a significant part of our budget.
Yes.
You don't want to go and slash your other things.
So I would say that, you know, overall, our power supply budget is a good portion of our budget. Now, the market purchases is a small piece of that overall. But, you know, it's also a good exercise for us to go through to say, okay, how can we manage our costs and manage through this sort of situation? You know, it is one of the risks of being a block slice customer. Mm-hmm. We are subject to the weather and kind of what that does. And so, you know, this is one of those tougher years. We have better years like last year and other previous years. And on average, we look at that whole thing. This is one of those more difficult years, so we need to manage through it.
And I realize that that is a relatively small segment of our purchases, but I just don't, that makes me a little nervous that I don't want staff to do knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah, no.
To, in terms of other parts of the operation.
Yeah, I would say.
I approve going back and managing to the number, but I just get a little nervous with.
Yeah, we'll look at what things make sense and take a methodical approach.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Yeah.
We don't do knee jerks in this field.
No, we got a great team, and you know, we all work together.
Well, I know
really
that.
Well,
I know that. But
we'll look to address the situation.
But I share your concern. I would hate to have us, you know, reduce spending on things that provide reliability or services to our customers, and so I know we've worked very hard. You guys worked very hard to make a pretty tight budget to start with. So
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, to Jason's point, it's good that we are realizing that early in the year, so that we can identify where we have opportunities, manage it throughout the year, and get to a glide path of where we want to be, so we can throttle up, throttle back, be very intentional, very methodical on how we do that to minimize the impact on other critical parts of the business.
Or a shift.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jason. Okay, next up again is Peter Donhauer, this time on our commercial and industrial time of day pilot extension.
Tried to grow a little bit in between the break there.
Back.
Just can't get rid of me. Also wanted to recognize Tom Hubdy, who's a senior executive account manager for Key Accounts, Customer Energy Services, who will be co-presenting. We're going to do a little switch midway through. And before we get started on this presentation, I just wanted to note, I had a meeting with the linemen yesterday, and that gave me a little insight that today is National Lineman Appreciation Day. I don't know if it's been recognized here, but I think we should recognize our linemen. They do an excellent job. Those people really important work for us. So today's the day. So just wanted to mention that before we get going.
Are you going to go to the, oh, I'm getting up top. Full top. I'm not going to do full top.
It's important to bring that to our attention.
Which is the
I read about the Lineman's Day, you know, was it National Lineman's Day or was it yesterday?
This is the day, National Lineman
today?
Appreciation Day.
Today, Lineman Appreciation Day.
And the wind's blowing. And the wind is blowing.
Sorry, I got us.
Yeah.
Sorry for the tangent, but just thought it was important to mention. In this presentation, I'll be talking about the commercial and industrial time of day rate pilot, the experience, and asked for a proposed extension. So this is a informational update, and I'm expecting to come back to the board for an extension, pilot, consideration, and future approval of a meeting. We're going to talk a little bit about background and then talk about our history with load shifting, winter load shifting, and then the program design, and then finally talk about some of the initial results that we've seen in the CNI time of day pilot. So first things first, I wanted to put the proposal up front. I already gave the summary here on the topics, but I wanted to put the proposal up front and talk through it, and then have a chance to sort of revisit that proposal at the end for some questions as well. Firstly, for the proposal, the staff is recommending an extension of the pilot through 2024. So as a brief background, you know, we started the pilot at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that slowed some of the initial recruitment that we saw as some of the larger CNI customers were considering how the pandemic is impacting them. I'm sure you know, we think this had an impact on their interest in the program to make big changes and so forth. So we also believe that an additional year of data will help us learn more about the time of day rate impacts for both the district and our customers. We have more customers with more data to review. We think that there'll be minimal cost to continue. Customers that are already on the rate will continue to benefit. So that's an advantage as well. And then finally, we can hope to minimize some of the disruption of having to move back to the base rates before going back to the time of day rates if they like those after connect up. So we hope to sort of minimize that as well. A little bit of background for time varying rates. This is 2017. You can see throughout the country, all those highlighted states had some sort of level of time dynamic rates. Time dynamic rates would include time of day, but also include a critical peak pricing, peak time rebates, different varieties of time varying prices where all of the prices might, or some of the, at some points in the day, the prices might vary as opposed to sort of static prices that we've historically been used to seeing. In more recent years, we've seen this trend continue. Northwest has been a laggard here, and there's interest in many of the Northwest utilities for pilots as well as full-scale rollout of time dynamic rates. I should say time dynamic also mean can also be said as time varying rates. At that same time, regionally, 2019 study done. But regionally, we are expecting increased likelihood of capacity shortages, as we've talked about here many times before, driven by retirements of multiple regional baseload generators and renewables, presumably filling in that gap where those renewables might have a lot of electricity or energy, but can't necessarily be accounted for on any given hour. So, on the graphic there, you can see each one of those lines would be different studies looking into the future of our capacity shortfall or deficit as a region. A few different entities producing these studies, all of them are saying over time that shortfall tends to grow and is a serious issue. So to address this particular issue, I can also use time varying rates like time of day. For the PUD, we can look at our own challenges, and kind of this works into the design of the rate itself. Each one of those lines is showing a different year. The colors correspond with the year, but basically, if you look at the last 5 years or so, that's one of these one of those lines there. And these are the winter months, November through February. You'll see a distinctive pattern of morning peak, evening peak there, pretty consistently. And in fact, those hours that are in between those yellow bars there are the ones that we consistently see the higher than normal energy requirements. That's what that's showing you there. And so particular, 71.1% of the above average energy use is between the hours of 7 to 9 and 17 through 20. We also know that about two-thirds of our peaking costs are in those months as well. And so if we're able to shift some of those load away from those peak periods, then we can help the district reduce some of those costs and keep our cost pressures lower than they otherwise would be. We wouldn't have to build as big of a system. We wouldn't have to go buy on the market as much. That's kind of what we're trying to do here with this rate design.
I have a question about, does this count toward our conservation credits? Because it seems to be that it is a way of conserving energy.
So
is that different?
Yeah, it's a kind of a technical answer here, but you know, in terms of an energy resource, does this provide an energy resource? Does it reduce our energy through some kind of conservation? Typically, time of day is not going to be an energy resource. It's going to be more of a shift in the demand when that energy is required. It's more of a demand resource, typically. There can be some sort of combinatorial effects there. Both, but generally speaking, it's usually for demand. So our shape of our load is different, and what we need to fill that shape can be different as well. Okay, to talk a bit more about our historical load shifting efforts, as well as the program design, is Tom Hubby.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here in front of you and to my colleagues and others in attendance. So I wanted to first start off by highlighting some of what we've done, excuse me, in the demand management area previously. Some of you may recall that we were part of the EPA InterNOC administration, the demand response pilot back in 2015 to 2017. Joined with several other utilities and responding to BPA call events. Those entities whose logos are represented, Alderwood and King County, City of Everett, City of Edmonds, over on the right, were participants back at that point. So a lot of the benefit they were able to achieve is due to their storage capabilities. We additionally added in our battery in the second year of the pilot. So we had some opportunity to test the utility battery. And we worked through that. Customers benefited in terms of being paid for their resource reduction. But at the end of that pilot, we decided we were going to take a slightly different tact. As you can see here, winter peak load shifting was the next approach that we did internally here at the community. And it was operated more like an energy efficiency program. To Commissioner Wolf's point, we attempted to identify with customers making projections of how much load they could reduce and what was their actual result. It turned into be an analytical challenge that we did not feel was giving us the benefit that we wanted to achieve. Also notice here that last bullet, the view switching was not anticipated to be part of the program. We did not provide incentives if they shifted to backup generation, fossil fuel backup generation. We were talking about reducing their loads, turning things off, control systems, and so forth. So that led us into creating the CNI time of day pilot.
So Tom, did that happen among some of those customers that they would generation capacity, fossil fuels?
We thought it was possible.
Okay.
To our knowledge, it did not happen.
Thank you.
But we recognize
it's a possibility.
Yeah, and yeah. We as a utility have a commitment to move away
right
towards clean energy. So we wanted to emphasize how we were approaching that. So as Peter talked about, we've been exploring different rate options to reduce the pressure on the utility in terms of going out and buying when prices are high. The basic concept here is that there are different prices for energy at different times of day. I will be showing some more specific information on what prices we've added in the rate schedule that you're being asked to consider extending. And so the basic structure there, nights and weekends, obtain a discount, peak periods, morning and evening. Those are 7 to 9 a.m., 5 to 8 p.m. winter months. We would have a higher price, have an adder added to them. So we're trying to encourage, facilitate shifting behavior, basically, among the participants. So you can see here that nights and weekends was a reduction of what in the two-thirds on the KWH charge, and that's 46% of the hours in the total operational year. Weekdays was a little bit higher, as you can see, about a third of a cent, and then the adder for rate schedule 20 was sizable, 10 plus cents per KWH. This was identified as revenue neutral in 2019, this particular approach. And Peter will be happy to answer any questions related to that aspect. I'm the co-lead of the pilot and really appreciated the opportunity. I focus on customer engagement here, as you know, where it focuses on the race impact. So what that diagram or the illustration on the right identified some of the measures we anticipated customers could take to reduce their load during peak periods. Controls is a big one. Automating processes and so forth. Reheating, pre-cooling was another opportunity. And customers have done that. Here's a list of the 14.
Can you go back to slide 11, the one you just did? Thing on the right, what does automating processes mean?
Automating processes, in terms of, that could be the turning on of equipment so that they could actually set the equipment so it does not all come on at once. It's staggered, turns off at an appropriate time,
okay. That
kind of thing. We found often that standard practice has been things just keep running when they don't really need to. So that's part of operation and maintenance. So the 14 participants are identified here at a type. On the left-hand side, as I look at it, the opt-in to time of day rate, are 5 customers chose to actually be charged at the time of day rate. Those customers on the right, the 9 customers on the right, chose the other track. And the other track is called rate comparison. They stay on the existing rate, 20 or rate schedule 36. We provide them a monthly analysis report, which I will be giving some visuals of what their charges would have been had they been on the time of day rate. So they're getting a perspective on what impact that could have on them. The time of day opt-in customers, on the other hand, are now being charged by the time of day rates. So that monthly analysis report says what would their charges have been had they stayed on their previous existing rate. And we found that as a really effective way to communicate to those customers what the impacts are going to be. It's a learning process for us, definitely a learning process for them. As you can see here, we have indoor egg grower. Peter will be talking about some of the results related to that particular customer. The manufacturer that opted in first, right away in July 2020, they had determined, based upon our discussion with them, that this was a benefit to them. So, and that in fact has been the case, but it's not the case for every customer. The changes can be significant that they have to make.
So
Sorry, go ahead.
Tom, is there a type of customer that has done the best? That's a kind of industry. I mean, maybe not just here, but in the nation, or there are certain things, companies, kinds of companies where they lend themselves. But
for us, it's the flood control districts. Okay. On a broader basis, it's customers who have processes or operations that have flexibility in them. In the case of the manufacturer, they have two shifts. They have a natural slowdown at the end of the first shift, and then they pick up and start on the second shift. They were able to delay the start of their energy intensive processes on that second shift. So any entity that has storage, could be wastewater treatment, or has a significant potential. The water systems, they have storage.
If you want to pump.
Yeah.
So the list on the right, those are kind of your control group. If you're doing it like a research, well, it is a research.
It is a research project.
Kind of your control group, because they're not doing time of day, is that right?
Yes, to a limited extent. I mean, we were, from the participation aspect, we're not statistically identifying how many we need, but you know, to be statistically.
But in general, it's kind of like.
In general, I think that's.
You do these rate comparisons.
I think that's a good way of visualizing it.
Are there any things that we've looked at behind the meter, like selecting a certain process? So I can understand customers being reluctant to switch, not, you know, having a certain what that will look like, but they might have a process in their thing that they're pretty certain they could change. We done anything to look at whether we can support them in, maybe I'm thinking like when hot water is heated for large facilities or things like that. Are there?
Yes, we have. Actually, we bring an energy efficiency engineer with us to consult with a customer. We did have one manufacturer who tried various strategies, and they found that they were, excuse me, they found that they were really not able to make any shifts in their approaches. Controls has been the most effective. Just for when things cycle on, when things cycle off today. But yes, we've offered, and there have been some projects that have come out of this. So.
I guess what I was asking, is there a way we can reward them, even if they choose not to change the rate structure? Can we reward them one aspect of their business? Can we install a special meter on devices or something? Is that worth our while?
We have done that.
Okay.
If they are actually investigating,
yeah.
I think it's the situation you're talking about. Whether if they did this, equipment or process change, would it make a major difference? We've brought out Muskrat data loggers to actually monitor that that activity.
Right.
So we continue to offer that
as
we
go forward.
Do we have any school districts participating? Because the kids go home at 3-4 o'clock, and it seems like they would be good candidates to. They probably do anyway, don't they? Turn the heat down.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. In that winter peak load shifting pilot.
Sure.
We did have one school district, but schools have chosen not to participate
right.
in this. This was an invite. Invitation only. Mm-hmm. Since then, we've offered. Schools have chosen.
Maybe we're just doing it already.
In many respects,
we're
yes.
Doing our best. Yeah.
And we have a number of schools that are in our Clean Building Accelerator program, so they're focused on some of the same
right.
types of saving energy.
Right. Yeah. Did you say we're going? Oh, excuse me, I interrupted somebody. We're going to see some analysis later on in terms of the results for
yes, Peter,
each one of these. Okay, great. Because I'm really curious about the value to the indoor egg grower. So we're going to learn more about that.
Yes, you will.
Okay.
So this is part of the Mars report. monthly analysis report that each of the participants receives every month. And the top 6 months are actual, but what actually they had in the form of usage. As you can see here, the November, December, it breaks out the peak periods, and then it's the nights and weekends here. And then very straightforwardly over here, this 574, for example, for November, indicates they would be charged $574 more if they were on that time of day rate than if they were on their existing. The green numbers are all less, fewer charges. So on an annual basis, we find this is what customers often look at. On an annual basis, the projected savings there are $2,200. So that's how we're reporting to those customers what the impacts are or what the impacts could be. We've had some very, very active responses on the part of customers. It encourages me that there's a level of interest for when we do have a more defined time of day rate. And I am now transitioning the talking stick back to Peter.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Tom. Okay, apologies in advance for the busyness of this slide, but hopefully you'll find it interesting. It has been an interesting set of years here. What we're trying to do here is to show some of the changes in load shapes over time. And the specific metric is the percentage of energy above or below flat energy for a given month. So if you took all the energy of that particular user in that month, and you made it flat, and then actually went back and said, okay, typically flat would be a, you know, single value over the whole month. They didn't, and that's ideal because that's very easy to predict and to manage for. And then if you went back to that same month and said, well, how much is in this hour versus that hour? That's that kind of shape that you're seeing there. So if it was a flat, full flat shape, it would be at the 0% line all the way across. So this allows us to really see where the peaks are here. Now overlaid against that is the peaking hours in the rate. It's a little different than the some of the hours I may have showed previously, but it's 2 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the evening for this redesign. And the objective is to really shift energy out of those hours that are in the yellow bars there.
So I'm sorry, I'm confused about what is graphed here. Load of all the customers that are in the pilot?
In this case, it's aerospace too, so a manufacturer that's
okay,
been in
okay.
The pilot that is on the time of day.
Got it.
Yep. Thanks for that question. And the different colors tell you different years. And so working from the oldest to the newest, the oldest are the black ones, and then 2021 would be pink, and then 2022 is blue, and 2023 is green. So those are the years that they have been on the actual opting component of this. This particular customer is in the pilot on the time of day, shown by the solid line there. Prior to that, you get these sort of dashed lines, which indicate they aren't yet on the time of day going over the pilot. And there was no pilot back in 2019, so that's just their data, right? So what's interesting to see is the changes over time, as well as the sort of variation that we might see despite the rates. So you can see that certainly the solid lines there, the colorful lines, we see some improvements, for the most part in the PM window there. See lower percentages than the sort of dashed lines, except for 2023. And I should also mention that this is just for the month of February. So just looking at February's over these years, just for simplification, but we look at all the months too. And you can also see some of the, where the peaks are landing, you know, there's a little bit more of a flatter peak in hours 7 through 15 or so in the prior years, and we see higher peaks kind of in the midday. So this would indicate that we see some efforts to kind of shift a little bit over away from the morning, as well as to really reduce the sort of PM peak coincidence there. But it's not all perfect. You can see that obviously 2023, there's been higher peak usage in the PM window, but also lower usage in the AM window. So you have to imagine this customer is sort of considering everything going on and saying, well, sometimes it's worth it, sometimes it's not, trying to change or not even pay attention to the rate in some cases, because there's important business processes that say, hey, this is fine, this is good enough for me right now. Yeah. However, I can look at some of the financial, the sort of bill impacts for this particular customer. Generally speaking, it's good. Go ahead.
Does temperature have an effect on these customers? Have we normalized it for weather? Or?
This is not normalized for weather. Unfortunately for CNI customers, each one is pretty idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
And it's something that we intend to do by the time the pilot is done, but we haven't done it as of yet. But you know, this wastewater district versus that manufacturer versus the school, versus transit company, each interag, each one of them is going to have different responsiveness to weather conditions and business conditions that are sometimes very difficult to apply across industry as well. So to your question, Commissioner Wolf, about creating controls, you know, what's the true control for one of these customers? Well, you could take it on the wastewater district for the wastewater district. Then they have different precipitation conditions, and the exact timing is difficult to make just to choose and select controls like this. A lot of kind of statistical manipulation is needed to find a good control.
Manufacturers probably shipping, sometimes they might have to hurry up and get more done in the time and they wouldn't choose to otherwise. So, and they're probably just lots of factors.
And some of this type of data that we might use to produce a control that considers that is not always available. So we don't know their production schedule, their inventory levels, and there's also impacts on that sort
of
economy. What's that?
Many variables.
Many variables, yeah. So this is, I think, going to be a challenge for load research to come as we try and do better and better at predicting what these types of customers might be using more and more data sources that we have available to us. But it's definitely an area where we're improving. So I wanted to just get back to here, looking at the load shape changes now to compare the load shape changes to the impacts to the bills. Again, looking at this very same customer. There's a lot of numbers on one side. So don't worry about reading all those numbers. I've already done the math on the left-hand side there for you, but I thought it might be interesting to see how it kind of plays out over time. And it's hard to see on this, where I'm standing, the green component, but that green component is the years that this customer has been in the time of day. So they're actually getting these adjustments on their bill. So they opted in 2022, their average 2021 monthly consumption is 165 megawatt hours, just to give you a sense of the scale here. And if you look at the bills 2020 through 2022, they did have higher peaking costs, about $6,300. They had higher midday costs, $18,500 or so, some higher costs in those components of their bill. But the off-peak savings was $87,684, offsetting those additional costs. Overall savings of about $63,000. What's also interesting to note is if you do look at that block of numbers there, the bottom right shows a savings of $92,396. This would be the savings that they would have achieved if they had been able to join back in 2018. So a customer like this, generally speaking, has a pretty good shape, and this is probably why they joined immediately into the pilot, right? Good shape, they have a lower cost for the PD, and we're conveying some of these savings back to this customer. uh, Little variation. This is an indoor ag customer. This is looking at, again, February's from 2020 through 2023. Again, the colors will tell you when they're in the pilot. So they have been opted into the actual rate with those solid lines for the last 3 years. The dashed line that's black means that they were not opted in at that point. That would have been their shape beforehand. It is 2020, so keep in mind that a lot of changes happening in 2020 and even the last few years on load shapes and how all of our customers, but business customers too, are managing the pandemic changes. But you can see excellent avoidance of the morning peak. You can see that they definitely bump up immediately after that peak, so that is a moment where they're definitely tracking that and scheduling their operations around it. In 2023, you can also notice that there's a big pickup of that evening load taking advantage of that lower rate. Whether or not this was a decision for the rate or just an opportunity that they said, well, if we're going to schedule something, some operation, let's do it in the evening time as opposed to another time of day. As far as the evening peak period, that is definitely the continual challenge. 2021 and 2023, see that they did a little bit better than in 2022. It was our highest peak at that point. So this is the kind of timeline that when we think about C&I customers going on time of day, making business decisions alongside a changing market environment and what they're trying to do. It's gonna be a sort of longer time frame of how to optimize their operations around these rates. We're not always going to see them do the optimal thing from a rate perspective, because they also have to make money, deliver the other services that they provide, transportation, education. You can't always shift everything around, is what I'm getting at. One more example. I think this is the last example I have to show today, but looking at a wastewater district. This is a wastewater district that has been in some previous pilots, the winter peak load shifting pilot to be exact. And so looking at data back to 2019, again for February as an example, and this is a stellar performance in avoiding these pilots. You can tell that they've done a lot here to really avoid our peaks. Even saying that, just look at the PM, AM peaks there, and look at the solid lines and see some of the variation that we see. So, some of those times they're making the choice to say, yeah, we're going to need to, bring up the pumping, take care of whatever business they have to do. There's going to be that type of variation, but overall, this is exactly what we're trying to see. Even some improvements compared to the shifting pilot.
Why are there two sets of the black dotted lines?
Yeah, so apologies for the scales here, but those correspond to two different years, 2019 and 2020. And in both of those years, instead of a solid line, which would indicate they would be in the opt-in part of the pilot, they were not. So it's dashed.
Yep.
And so now we can kind of look at a summary to date. This puts together all of the opt-in customers only. And just looking at a couple of months, January and February, to show a little variation there. And what we can see for all these customers that are actually getting the rate, we see some really nice sort of concerted efforts to avoid these peaks. We do see some variation, but imagine if those peaks weren't there and weren't trying to do this, we could very well see those gaps between the sort of hours before and after the peak, really looking at the PM, seeing those filled in a bit more. So that's the type of value that we're getting out of this pilot. So again, this is really exciting to be able to share these types of opportunities with customers that are really taking concerted efforts to shift energy around and convey some of those savings to them as well. And this would kind of put all the customers that are together who are in the opt-in. Just to quickly summarize here, there's been 10.7 thousand in winter peaking costs, about 30,000 in mid-day costs that are additional to what they would have gotten on their bills. But the peak savings has outweighed that 160K in peak savings. Overall savings for the customers are about 120K. Of course, the pilot right now. Back to what's next. Staff is recommending the pilot to be extended through 2024 so we can get more data that we can continue with our recruitment efforts into. Minimal cost that we expect to the district. Continuing to allow customers who are on it benefiting from it to continue to do that, sort of minimize some of the disruption as we think about how we implement time of day rates after it connects up. We'd like to come back to the commission and hope to ask for your approval.
All right. We're doing this. Thank you. Great presentation.
Back room. We're supporting is still manual.
Can you say your question?
The back room work supporting is still manually done.
We use quite a few sort of software support for it, but we are still doing it, yes. Yeah, but it is going to be feeding into our load research techniques in the future. What we're thinking about is AMI and with teacher rates that we have, some of the other big investments that we've also made, My Snowbud, for example, you know, how that would fit into ongoing sort of load forecasting, supporting customers to make good decisions before they jump on to different options that they might have, helping that level of awareness so that they know what is actually going on. So there are some investments that would sort of build on this learning here.
Any openings for math majors?
We're hiring right now. So if anybody's listening that join our department and do this kind of cool work.
My grandson is graduating on May 6th in math, and he's just brilliant.
All right. Yeah, we love math majors. Right?
Yeah, he's done very well, I have to say.
Congrats.
Off topic, but
congrats anyway.
Really proud.
All right.
Excellent job, Peter.
Thank you.
Last presentation for the morning is our 2022 audit results. Sean Hunstock. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Thank you, commissioners. I'm Sean Hunstock, senior manager, controller, auditor. I have to get used to that new title. I have the pleasure today of introducing Olga Darlington from Moss Adams. They recently completed the 2022 financial audits for the PUD. And I just have to say quickly, it's been a pleasure working with Olga and her staff. They've been a great resource for myself and my staff, as well as the finance department in general. And with that, I will turn it over to Olga. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
All right. So the 2022 financial statement audit is completed. We have issued our opinions, and today I have a short presentation with some of the highlights for you. So the first and most important highlight is that the opinions that we issued are unmodified, which in accountant speak is clean opinion. This is a scorecard for the district with respect to its financial records, its annual report, and information that's included in there. It means that information presented is in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, which is a general standards for financial reporting. We performed our audit in accordance with government auditing standards, which require a little bit of a heightened level of procedures that we have to perform, specifically those related to assessing internal controls surrounding the financial reporting. So if we find any issues or control weaknesses in that assessment, we will include that in our report. And once again, I'm pleased to report there were no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies with respect to those processes that we evaluated for us to include in the report. So both reports are clean, clean bill of health, if you will. We did have an additional audit that we had to perform in the current year, and this is specific to expenditures of federal awards that the district received during a year. This is a compliance audit. There's a set of standards that we have to follow in performing that audit. Total federal expenditures, and once again, this is federal dollars as opposed to state dollars, although they may come through state agencies. Total federal expenditures were a little in excess of $14 million. There is one particular grant that we selected to test as a major program, and that was the grant that came through Department of Treasury, Coronavirus, State and Local Fiscal Recovery Funds, more commonly known probably as the Arrearages Grant. So this is $11.1 million that were received to help assist with customers who were able to pay on their bills that was accumulated balances through the pandemic relief. So no findings in that report as well. Also clean report card there. I always like to highlight some of the areas of audit focus. The audit is a big effort. My presentation today is very short, but it's a big undertaking for the auditors and more so for the district. One, to just comply with all of the requests that we have throughout the audit process, but more importantly, keeping up with those processes throughout the year. So the internal control environment that I mentioned earlier, on which we have to assess internal controls so we can report all of those different processes that feed into financial reporting process, payroll, customer billings and collections, cash disbursements, grants management, all of those processes we evaluate by talking to individuals in those respective areas, performing some tests and making sure the controls are in place and there is no breakdown in processes throughout the year. Capital assets is another big area. Lots of dollars going through construction and process and just capital assets recorded on the balance sheet in general. We do take selections of projects that are ongoing throughout the year, as well as those that have been completed. We do have discussions with project managers, as well as looking at the cost additions that have been recorded to those projects throughout the year, as well as retirements. There was new debt activity in the current year, so we tested that issuance of the new revenue bonds, as well as the repayment of all of the existing outstanding bonds and notes, making sure the district is in compliance with any debt covenants. Revenue recognition is another big process because the district has so many customers, residential, commercial, industrial, so we use a combination of techniques from transaction testing for some of the larger billings to more analytical testing for residential and commercial customers, taking into consideration the amount of energy and water used throughout the year, as well as number of customers, rate changes throughout the year, as well as some of the weather patterns. So that's one of the big areas of testing. There was one new accounting standard that was really significant in the current year that the district implemented, and that's GASB 87 related to leases and lease reporting, which resulted in additional assets and liabilities recorded in the financial statements, as well as restatement of 21 financial records to conform so that the 2 years presented in the annual report are comparative. So that was a big undertaking for the district, and assessment was performed of all of the existing contracts in place according to the criteria set out in the accounting standard for what is determined to be a lease, and that asset and liabilities have been recorded correctly. So lots of work there. Some of the required communications that we are required by auditing standards to let you know about. Accounting policies that the district follows, we evaluate those throughout the year, make sure that disclosures in the financial statements are consistent with other like entities. Management estimates is an area that involves management's knowledge about historic events and just operations of the district. So those are areas that we evaluate in greater detail because we're not able to conform those balances to third party confirmations or just detailed testing. So some of those are very common: allowance for doubtful accounts, accrued liabilities for claims and damages, depreciable lives of assets, actuarial valuations, and now additional item related to lease receivables and liabilities, because it does include a little bit of an estimate there with respect to net present value of cash flows. Pleased to report there were no disagreements with management. We have a lot of conversations and kind of back and forth about application of accounting standards, policies, controls in place, and so forth. But at the end of the day, there were no disagreements that we need to alert you about. I mentioned the new, this is before the new accounting standard. One of the areas that we have to let you know about, if there were any audit adjustments recorded as a result of our work, any findings, if you will, that we had that required adjustments to the financial information presented to us. Once again, pleased to report there were no audit adjustments that we have identified that needed to be reflected in the financial statements. Once again, the information that we presented is clean and accurate, which means the information that you receive throughout the year and management uses throughout the year and the processes for budgets setting, as well as just, different decision making, is also following the same standards and accurate. We did propose one adjustment entry, and this is more of a reclassification at the financial statement level of where certain revenues, grant revenues, are reported, but it did not have an impact on that position of the district overall, so just a reclassification entry. And I did mention the new accounting standard that was recorded. The lease receivable was about $23 million. The lease liability was about $4.1 million. Once again, those are the new balances in the financial statements and new policies related to those. And financial records for 2021 were restated. There is a paragraph in our audit opinion regarding that restatement, but it does not did not impact the unmodified opinion that we issued. As far as we know, management didn't consult with other accountants on application of accounting standards or auditing matters. And as any other business entity, district is exposed to claims and legal issues as it's doing business and providing services to its customers. Those are disclosed in commitments and contingencies footnote to the financial statements. Once again, those are relevant to the readers of the financial statements. I'm not going to go through the detail of new accounting standards. I just wanted to give you a perspective of what's coming, what the team here at the district has to deal with in the coming years. The GASB has been very, very active in issuing new standards. And of course, GASB is a standard setting body that issues accounting standards that district follows for its annual reporting. There is a list of things that's coming up in the next couple of years. The bigger one is right there in the middle. It's in bold. GASB 96 subscription-based information technology arrangements. It's standards very similar to the GASB 87 leasing standard that the district just adopted, except it's applicable for IT arrangements. So software as a service, cloud computing type arrangements. Once again, another big undertaking, because the most clients I work with have some type of arrangements there that on the IT side that relate, that it would be scoped into. So we'll be working with the district management in this year for reporting in 2023 in that implementing that new standard. I do have our contact information. This is our leadership team. If you have any questions after this meeting that comes to mind, we're always open for reach out and have a discussion. And the most important slide of my presentation is a big thank you to the district staff. I always say our audit takes us to different departments within the district, not just the finance and accounting. We talk to people throughout the organization, including the executive team, and everybody is very helpful. And provides the schedules and the answers to our questions, and very respectful, so, which allows us to complete our audit on time, so, and meet the deadlines. That concludes my presentation, but I'm open for any questions.
I appreciate what you do, believe me. It's good to get a clean audit.
Like I said, it takes a lot of effort. We start in November and perform some work preliminarily, and then we come back for a few weeks in February and March. And this year we were lucky, I think we were lucky, to be on site after a couple of years of virtual audits. So it was very, very helpful to have that face time with the team here in the district. So,
you know, a question, just a comment, you know, it's always wonderful to hear that the audit and staff work so well together. I'm impressed that, you know, we have $11 million federal audit that is a really quick pivot to all our customers. And I know my own experience with federal grants is that audits can be challenging. So it's impressive that we got a clean opinion.
Yes, and it speaks highly of the communication we have with the management team throughout the audit, because that particular grant, as you probably know, was received later in the year and it had to be implemented in a very time or tight timeline. And so we had conversations with management from the start of when that grant was signed to make sure that the management wanted to make sure we had what we needed to audit it and not have any potential findings. So, and we have that communication throughout the year for any significant transaction that a district has, which really helps at the end of the year when we come to the audit time.
That's great. I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your presentation. See you next time. Yes.
Thank you, Olga. And a huge thank you to your team and to Scott and Sean and the entire. It's a huge lift for all parties. So that's it. Good morning.
It is now 11:37, and the meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.